would like to see a situation in which whatever differences exist among states are resolved through peaceful rather than warlike means. History is not kind to that approach, but it is something that we all be looking for.
An opportunistic former KGB official, Vladimir Putin continues to stir up conflict in Europe and present himself as a force to be reckoned with. Using Russian arms, Putin has successfully amassed power and has orchestrated successful military operations in Chechnya, Georgia, Moldova, and Syria. Popular uprisings in Belarus, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan over the past 2 years are being held back by direct Russian intervention, and Putin continues to exert influence over Europe through its immense energy resources. Now, a massive buildup of Russian forces encroaches upon Ukraine, threatening to invade the country. The United States has started evacuating embassy staff from Kyiv, and the people of Ukraine are preparing for a prolonged war. It is clear that Russia's behavior and Putin himself presents a clear destabilizing force against change in the former Soviet Union. What is Putin doing in Europe? What led to Russia's more aggressive position? And how can NATO play a role in checking Putin's imperial expansionism and protect the self-determination of countries in the former USSR?
Ivo Dalder is president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He served as the U.S. ambassador to NATO from 2009 to 2013. Prior to his appointment as ambassador to NATO by President Obama, Dalder was a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, specializing in American foreign policy, European security and transatlantic relations, and national security affairs. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Dalder, for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yes. So you began your most recent foreign affairs article with James Goldgeier by discussing NATO expansion. And specifically, you mentioned the 1975 Helsinki Final Act and the 2008 Bucharest Summit. Could you give our listeners a brief overview of what these treaties entailed and what was their significance on NATO's eastward enlargement?
Sure. So 1975 Helsinki Final Act was an important document for many years in the negotiations by what was called the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, which involved all the European states as well as Canada and the United States. Discussing sort of what are the core principles of security in Europe. Remember, this is in the middle of the Cold War, in which NATO and the Warsaw Pact are armed to the teeth, standing across each other, across Germany, against each other. Germany is still divided. But some core principles are included in the Helsinki Final Act, which is divided into sort of three parts. And the one that's important for our current discussion is the idea that formally, at least, the states of Europe are independent and sovereign, and that formally they can choose their own alliances. Now, of course, we know that in 1975, the countries in Eastern Europe in particular weren't able to choose their own alliances. They were occupied by the Russians and the government, by the Soviet Union, and the governments in those areas were tightly linked to Moscow. And whenever one of them decided that perhaps they needed a change, Moscow was willing to use military force to do so. Did so in 1953 in East Germany, did so in 1968 in the Czechoslovakia, 1956 in Hungary, and in 1980 helped the Poles do that in Poland. But that's what the Helsinki Final Act is. At its core, it has this principle that states are independent and that they can choose their own alliances. Why is this important? Because by 2008, or indeed by the mid-1990s, when the Warsaw Pact no longer exists, when the Soviet Union no longer exists, countries that used to be part of the former Soviet Union, or indeed part of the Warsaw Pact, said they wanted to join NATO. They wanted to be part of the Western group of countries. They wanted to join the European Union. A whole bunch of them did. Back in 1999, of course, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland became members of NATO. 2004, another seven countries were admitted, including the three Baltic states that have been part of the Soviet Union. But also countries like Slovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania became part of NATO. And in 2008, there was a discussion within NATO on who would next be invited possibly to come into NATO. And the difference was really manifest over two particular countries, Ukraine and Georgia. The United States led the effort to begin a process of bringing Ukraine and Georgia into NATO and wanted NATO to sign up to that. On the other side, there were countries who disagreed with that, particularly Germany and France. They said that those countries aren't ready yet. Bringing in Ukraine and Georgia is a little different than bringing in Poland. These are countries with very close relationships with Russia. Moscow is going to look at this askance, and therefore we need to be careful to bring those countries into the fold. And in 2008, at the Bucharest summit of NATO leaders, there was a 24-hour, even 36-hour debate about how to resolve this difference. And in the end, this is how they resolved it. They agreed that Georgia and Ukraine would not formally enter into the process by which the possibility of membership is considered. It's a process called the Membership Action Plan. So they were denied their application for a Membership Action Plan. But NATO also at the same time said that at some point in the future, and here's the quote, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, even though there was no agreement on when that might happen, if ever, frankly. So those are the two core principles. Countries should be able to choose their own alliances. That's the Helsinki Final Act. And in 2008, NATO did promise that Georgia and Ukraine would become members of NATO. Without ever stating when. And it's a sentence that has been repeated in every NATO summit communique ever since, including as recently as a few weeks ago by the NATO Secretary General.
So you also mentioned not just the ability of countries to choose their own alliances, but also the ability of people to freely choose their own leaders. And you wrote that Putin fears this. He fears the ability of people to freely choose their own leaders. And we obviously have witnessed over the past 10 years how Putin has undermined democracy at home and sought to dictate the destinies of Russia's neighbors by undermining uprisings, especially ones that were against the Russian-backed government in Russia's near abroad. Why does the success of democracy in Russia's periphery scare Putin and his allies so much, especially with successful democratic revolutions in, as the countries you mentioned, Ukraine and Georgia?
Yeah, so Putin's power is not based on democracy. Every election that has happened since he came to power in 1999, remember, he came to power as the appointed president when Boris Yeltsin, who was elected popularly, step down. Every election since it has been less free, less fair, and more manipulated by Putin and the center. Russia no longer is a real democracy. It's not it's a place where elections are held, but the candidates that are allowed to run are limited and need to be approved by the central authority, and anyone who in any way poses a threat to Putin in an election is prevented from running, as has been true with Alexei Navalny, probably the most popular opposition leader in Russia, who is now in jail and in fact has been denied the ability to run for office. So Putin's power is not based on that of the people. He's not freely chosen. And he worries that if successful countries that are democracies in which the people do choose their leaders emerge in Russia's periphery, particularly in parts in those countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, that the Russian people themselves are going to ask the same question. If this is good enough for Ukraine or for Belarus or for Kazakhstan or for Georgia why isn't free and fair elections as a way to select our leaders the best way for Russia? And it is, in some sense, his fear of revolutions where popular demands for popular popular uprisings and demand for free and fair elections that defines what he's trying to do. He wants to control the immediate neighborhood to prevent this from happening. And when it does happen, he wants to make sure that it doesn't succeed, as it did in Georgia in 2003, which is why he intervened in that country in 2008. And as he tried to intervene in 2004 first in Ukraine, and then successfully did in 2014 after a second popular uprising in Ukraine. We've seen him supporting Lukashenko, the man known as the last dictator in Europe, the leader of Belarus, in the last couple of years when there was a popular uprising, and just a few weeks ago in Kazakhstan, he intervened in order to support fellow strongmen who rely on Moscow to stay in power in Kazakhstan. So that's his modus operandi. It's also what he fears. He fears democracy. He fears independence. He fears a Ukraine or a Georgia that decides where their future needs to lie, particularly if that future is different than being aligned with Russia.
So speaking of Russia's fears of democracy on its borders or nearby, and Russia's intervention intervention abroad, I'd like to transition to talk about what has been extensively covered in the news recently. So currently, there are 100,000 Russian troops amassed on Ukraine's border. The U.S. has started evacuating embassy staff from the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. And a decade ago, these realities would have seemed unfathomable. So what has transpired over the past decade that has motivated Russia to put 100,000 troops on Ukraine's border and breach so many international norms?
Well, the most important thing that has changed is first that the Russian military has become far more capable over the last 10 years. Significant investment in military capability and military hardware, in military training and military doctrine that has allowed Russia to use the military in ways that previously were unsuccessful or unthinkable. And just remember in 2008 when it intervened in Georgia, the Russian military demonstrated a lot of weaknesses. It wasn't able to communicate well between troops. Some of its tanks and personnel carriers broke down, and there were a lot of problems of discipline and command and control of its military. In 2014, we saw a much more effective Russian military in Ukraine. You'll recall that it was little green men who all of a sudden showed up in Crimea that were able to almost surreptitiously take over and control of Crimea, and ultimately led to the political annexation of Crimea into Russia, and direct military support to insurgent forces in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. A year later, in 2015, a pretty successful Russian military intervention in Syria, including the use of cruise missiles from as far away as the Caspian Sea that were used to attack targets in Syria. So the Russian military just has become a lot more capable. And once you have a more capable military, your ability to affect political change through using military force has become much easier and better to handle. So that's one thing that's changed. The second thing that's changed is that Russia really hasn't paid a lot for using the military in the way that it has. It did invade in 2014 Ukraine, it annexed Crimea. It retains a capability, a significant capability in eastern Ukraine. Yes, the West put on sanctions, but for the rest, And the relationship deteriorated. Russia was thrown out of the G8, for example, and hasn't been invited back. But it's still a major player on the world stage, and so much so that in 2015 it was able to intervene without really any cost in Syria, and it has grown in influence in the Middle East, and it has a stronger relationship with China. And so the lesson that Vladimir Putin has learned is that when you use military force, you can actually get away with it. And he may have calculated that he could affect greater political change and achieve more in Ukraine by mobilizing this significant force, which, in fact, the mobilization started in early 2020. And we were worried at that time, in early 2021. So about a year ago, we worried at that time that he was massing a lot of forces on the Ukrainian border. In the end, pulled some of those back, though left a lot of the equipment. And now we have this increase of force. And that seems to be related to the idea that the United States is weak, that the withdrawal from Afghanistan shows that this is a right time for Russia to push the U.S. buttons and maybe not have a response, that Germany, which has a new government that in and of itself is deeply divided on the issue of Russia, might not be able to withstand pressure, that France is focused internally because of its elections that are coming up in April, that Britain, which has left the European Union, is also focused internally, that what's happening with COVID makes this a good time for Russia to engage in some mischief. I think they miscalculated, but I think that's what's behind what we're seeing at the moment.
So having seen past examples of the use of Russian military aggression in recent months and years, the prospect of war or conflict between Ukraine and Russia has put much of the international community on edge. And so with the backdrop of that, in early January and after a week of high-profile negotiations, Russia gave the United States and its European allies a series of ultimatums with regards to the crisis in Ukraine and the buildup of troops along the border. So could you briefly explain what these ultimatums were and how the U.S. and Europe responded?
Yeah, so the Russians put on the table, not only on the negotiating table, but then published on their website and the foreign ministry, two draft treaties, one with the United States and one with NATO. And although there are some elements of those draft treaties that are interesting and ought to be subject of negotiations, the core of those documents really came down to trying to, in some ways, reverse the last 30 years and try to turn the clock back to a time in which NATO had not yet brought in new members as part of the alliance and had not increased its military capabilities and presence in the territories of the new member states. So the core demands that are in those agreements or treaties, draft treaties, are first that NATO provide a written guarantee that it will not consider any further enlargement of the alliance, specifically not to Ukraine and other states of the former Soviet Union, but also to no states whatsoever, including countries that have never been part of Russia, or indeed of the Warsaw Pact, like Sweden and Finland, that remain outside the alliance but are close partners of the alliance. So that's demand number one. Demand number two was specifically not to deploy any military capabilities, let alone offensive military capabilities, in Ukraine or indeed in the territory of any former Soviet state, as well as to remove all U.S. nuclear weapons currently in Europe from Europe back to the United States. And third, a demand that the equipment and military infrastructure and capabilities that were deployed to Eastern Europe since 1997 be withdrawn to the place where they were prior to 1997. So those were sort of the three core demands that Russia put to NATO and the United States. The U.S. and NATO have now responded, again, in writing. Unlike Russia, they have not published those responses. But what we know from briefings by the NATO Secretary General and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is that we are not going to accede to those demands. We are not going to change the NATO treaty, which signed in 1949, includes Article 10, which under which European states can ask to join NATO if NATO can agree if doing so would increase security of the North Atlantic area. And nor are we going to reverse any deployment of military capabilities in the way in which we want to defend NATO allies that have joined since 1997. As to the question of offensive military capabilities in Ukraine, President Biden has said that he's willing to have a discussion about that, but it has to be reciprocal and that there can't be any agreement unless they are on strict reciprocity. So on the core demands, there has been no movement. And by the way, there's likely not to be any movement on those demands.
So the 2014 invasion of Crimea, which happened in the wake of the 2014 Ukrainian Revolution, was significantly less overt than what we are seeing now, 8 years later. In 2014, there were almost no bullets fired, and there was a mixture of covert and hybrid warfare that highlighted the relatively short conflict. Why have Russia and Putin changed strategy here? Is there a particular reason why they are signaling their willingness to use overwhelming force to achieve their goal? And do you see this as a sign of Putin's position strengthening or weakening?
So it's important to remember that although the Crimea takeover was relatively quiet, what happened in the Donbass since was not. 14,000 Ukrainians have died in the last 8 years because of the fighting that has occurred. Indeed, the fighting back in 14 and early 2015 was pretty intense. Russian body bags were coming back creating some political problems for Russia inside. So while the kind of activities, military activities that have been taking place in 14, 15 and since were not as overt and significant as apparently the Russians are preparing today, we shouldn't underestimate the damage that they caused, and indeed the casualties that have been inflicted, which, just think about it, if there were a war on our border, we would have probably lost about 100,000 people in comparable number to what the Ukrainians have lost over the last 8 years. That's a significant number of casualties, not to be underestimated. I think the reason why Putin is now deployed a large military capability is for one or two reasons. One, either for intimidation and the hope that Ukraine and Russia were, Ukraine and the West were sufficiently preoccupied with other issues that they might be able to or willing to give in to Russian demands without a war, given the overwhelming military capabilities that are being deployed. Or it is a sign that Russia really is serious about undertaking a major military operation of the kind that we haven't seen in Europe since the end of World War II. We don't quite know what it is yet. No one seems to know what it is. What we do know is the capabilities that are being deployed are significant and give Putin options that he didn't have 7 or 8 years ago. Whether he will use those forces to execute on those options is one of the big unknowns, and only really Vladimir Putin will know, and it's not even clear that he knows today what he's going to do with those forces.
So given this historical context and the current crisis in Ukraine, what should What should be the Biden administration strategy to resolve today's crisis and deter Russian aggression in the future?
So I think the basic crisis, response from the Biden administration has been appropriate. It's laid out a clear strategy. It's said, on the one hand, it has tried to indicate that a further military aggression by Russia would lead to very significant costs. Economic costs through sanctions that would be quite more severe than the ones that were imposed in 2014. It's worked very closely with European allies to get them on board on those sanctions. The kinds we're talking about are in effect banning Russian financial transactions with Western banking systems. The potential of imposing very severe export controls on U.S. technology of all kinds that are bound to hurt the Russian economy in a quite significant way. Also, a commitment to accelerate and enhance the kind of military equipment and support for Ukraine in case it is further attacked, so that it can execute the right to defend itself, and finally to bolster the U.S. and NATO presence in Eastern Europe, the very presence that the Russians are seeking to reduce, if not remove altogether. So those costs are significant, making it less likely that that Russia will in fact act and pose a real deterrent to Russian action. At the same time, Biden has made clear that he's willing to have a diplomatic negotiation, not on the issue of whether Ukraine will become a member of NATO or whether NATO will move forces away from the territory of its member states, but on a series of issues that we are concerned about, the kind of capabilities that Russia has deployed, and that we know the Russians are concerned about. Have conversations about nuclear arms control, of conventional arms control, of transparency and confidence building measures, and perhaps even a big discussion about the European security situation, not unlike the one that was concluded almost 50 years ago in Helsinki. So there's plenty to talk about. So that's basically the Biden approach, to say the choice is yours. We're prepared to go either way. To inflict significant harm if you do move further militarily against Ukraine, or to have a diplomatic outcome. And at the same time, the administration quite adroitly has been able to engage its European allies and created a united front with NATO. So I think under the circumstances, the administration has done what it needed to do. And if one of the reasons that Putin might have moved is that he thought that NATO was too divided and Biden too weak to accomplish either of those parts of the strategy, then I think he's being dissuaded from that.
So you said that the NATO response is pretty unified towards Russia as of now, but it seems that Germany and France do not seem to be on the same page as the US, UK, and other NATO allies, such as Poland, in terms of responding to Russian aggression. So why is this, if this is the case, and what can be done to unify the West's response to Russian aggression if it's not already unified enough?
So, there are always differences in NATO, and the reality is these are right now 30 countries. Most governments are elected by their people. They reflect different priorities, different sensibilities, different geographical locations, different interests. Under those circumstances, getting everyone to agree is a major diplomatic task. And yes, there will be differences. There will be differences on threat perception. There will be differences on the cost that you're willing to bear to deal with those threats. But the differences should not overlook the reality that there, in fact, is a quite unified response. This week, Germany has indicated that should Russia invade Ukraine, it would not proceed with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, something that It was unwilling to do openly for quite some time, and is now moving towards it. And so while there are differences, the reality is that NATO has always demonstrated in the past, and I think will demonstrate in this particular case, that if they need to act, it will act in concert. And the higher the provocation and the more the significant the provocation, the more likely it is that there will be that kind of unified response by NATO. So I look at the situation as one in which I think the alliance is as unified as it has ever been, and is able and willing to act as one, even though differences remain as is always the case.
So kind of looking more long-term, as long as Vladimir Putin is the leader of the Russian Federation, will we be able to see true rapprochement between Russia and NATO? Even after Putin leaves office, are there seeds planted that will allow the West and Russia to work more cooperatively in the future without resorting to these sort of archaic sphere of influence geopolitical gains?
So, you know, this is a really sort of fundamental question of analysis that students of international relations, like many of you and us who listen to this podcast, deal with all the time. It's a traditional level of analysis problem. Is the cause of what we're looking at systemic? Is it in the reality that as long as Russia is a great power, it will have great power interests that that compete with other great powers and therefore look to create spheres of influence? Is it in the nature of the Russian state as a state that a big landmass like Russia will always feel insecure, will always believe that it is being surrounded by enemies and therefore seek security by expanding its geographic reach, its empire, as it has throughout much of its history? Or is this really about the instincts and priorities of an individual, in this case, Vladimir Putin? And that as long as he is in power, the kind of policies that Russia has been pursuing over the past couple of decades under him are going to continue to be pursued. And, you know, the answer is probably some combination of all three, that there is a systemic reason for competition among great powers, that Russia as a landmass will have a natural tendency to feel insecure, and that Vladimir Putin has created a power structure that will always make him insecure, so long as there is the possibility that the people might rise up against him, which is something that is just inherent in dictatorships writ large. I think the best we can do is to try to create circumstances that enable the future leaders in Russia, to look beyond systemic and national causes and find ways to cooperate together with neighboring states and other great powers. We all would like to see a situation in which whatever differences exist among states are resolved through peaceful rather than warlike means. History is not kind to that approach, but it is something that we all be looking for. What's clear is that as long as Putin is in power, as long as he looks at his own security as inevitably tied up with the suppression of his own people and therefore the need to do so for in his neighboring countries, we're going to have the problems that we've been looking at in the past couple of decades.
So to wrap us up, looking more broadly, do you foresee the current developments in Ukraine changing the timeline for Ukraine and Georgia's accession to NATO? And if so, how?
No, I don't see the timeline changing. I think the possibility of either of those countries joining NATO has always been small, and nothing that has happened is going to change that.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. It was a great discussion.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.